The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Sin gets a charge out of a New Jersey schmo in Singapore. Peter gets fuzzy with his logic. Julie forgets to tell us she got a law degree. Wynn writes the best book ever for kids on cyber ethics. Ira's spy tailgates into a classified meeting, and lots more. All on today's Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
All.net's monthly members forum will be on Valentine's Day, Tuesday, the 14th of February. If you love, you gotta come.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. A massive Chinese balloon is hovering over the U.S. doing who knows what. Speculation is rampant about what it might contain and what it might do. According to defense officials, you can see it if you look up. However, its location is classified. In other news, the government states that overclassification is not a problem.
This is a segment we call Sin in America.
So let's talk about some of the detective work that you did. Can you just, you know, give us a general background on the stuff you did early on in terms of being, you know, cyber detective, we'll call it now, but whatever we were calling it then, who knows, right?
Yeah, from day one, I was calling it internet investigations. There was a couple areas, and they still are our strengths. I understood where information was created, stored, and disseminated. As a librarian, this is just my skill set. So detectives who are really the boots on the ground, the in-person, the surveillance, the interviewers, they would call me, and I would do all their online research. I would find articles, newspaper stories, SEC filings, whatever was accessible to them, and especially public records. A real strength of mine was understanding where all the public record information was. One of the first cases, a guy out of Colorado named Joe Dickerson was looking for someone who left the state. And I said, well, let me just try a LexisNexis newspaper search. And I found an article about him a month earlier. He was a visiting professor in Singapore. It was in the New Straits Time, which is a Malaysian English language newspaper. And said, you know, Dr. Schmo is out there talking about whatever he's talking about. And I called up Joe and I said, I think he's in Singapore because that article said he was there a month ago. And he goes, oh, that's great. What do I owe you? And I said, what do you owe me? I'm like, Wait a minute.
Oh, I should charge for this. Hey.
Oh, he squared me away real quick. I was like $50 and that was it. It was my first case and I haven't stopped.
But you're not doing it for $50 anymore, right?
No. No. We figured out the business end too.
Yeah, that's in many ways the harder part of it, right?
I think so. As I also try to represent for transitioning military and law enforcement as they come into this field, I try to explain to them in the kindest terms possible, you're very good at your skill set. You know exactly what you need to do to get the job done, but you don't know how to get the job. You don't know how to charge for the job. You don't know how to write a statement of work for the job. You have to learn all that framework. So that's something.
I thought the idea was you hire them and they do the job and you do all the paperwork and you pay them $50 and you get $500, right?
Well, there's a couple sides to the business. You know, there's some things you keep in house, but.
Yeah, I'm just saying. All right. Yeah. So I've had that similar experience with people coming out of government. There are a couple of symptoms that they have. One of them is they know how to spend money, but they don't understand that you're supposed to bring it in. Right. Because it's sort of, it's a budget and your job is to spend it so you can get it again next year, not to save it. So you have something left. And then
line items.
Yeah. And then there's another interesting problem that they seem to have. And that's what they always seem to think that they're supposed to do the work before they make a deal with you. It's like, no. Yeah. Make the contract, then do the work. They're used to being in an environment where you just do the work and all that paperwork comes later, right?
I have a class, the NSA and the Director of National Intelligence came down from on high and said, we need more cyber workforce. So they took a large amount of money and they're channeling it through, I want to say, Western Florida State. I get that college wrong all the time, but they're the institute that then funnels the money to the Cyber Skills to Work program. 18 or 20 different colleges are all have a piece of it. And I'm the piece through Dakota State University out of South Dakota, who has an amazing NSA Center of Academic Excellence program. I'm teaching OSINT to people online.
People don't know what it means. OSINT is?
Oh, I'm sorry. Open Source Intelligence. It's what we call internet investigations today. So it's open source intelligence, and it's the hot new term. And the federal
government. But it's not just the hot new term, right? That is, the vast majority of the intelligence you can get now is open source. And you can find out way more over the internet than you can find out almost any other way. And then you add these new AI things, these bots that just fuse all this information together. Sometimes you ask them a couple of questions and they start to tell you stuff that is, you know, classified, from somewhere else in the world, you're finding out about where people are. It's astonishingly more effective than the closed source intelligence. And the intelligence agencies have some difficulty in grasping that, in my experience.
I could only back up everything you just said. And I've been doing a lot of work with them in the last, especially year and a half. Even the DOD, Department of Army, doesn't have a job title for an open source intelligence soldier. They have every type of intelligence but that. We've actually been training with them. So that's why I got tapped to do this program. The government 10 years ago was putting billions of dollars into getting soldiers to speak Arabic. 5 years ago, it was drones. Well, now we're looking at potentially a $27 billion drop in teaching open source intelligence, which this girl does.
So I have to talk to you about getting with Aizen, who was on the show a month or two ago. Because, you know, they do online courses. And so you can't scale your teaching if you're sitting in a classroom. But if you can get with them for something online, for example, you can scale this. And big programs, you know, they're trying to train a lot of people.
Yeah.
And just getting to that many people is difficult. And so, you know, being able to do this. And the other thing is getting the information out to people that are remote in underserved communities is
I love that. Actually, a portion of this, of what I'm trying to do is to get this type of material to, we call them victims to victors, victims of domestic violence, and also people who have been trafficked and other undereducated or underprivileged or underopportuned individuals. Because again, I always have a little place in my heart for, you know, empowering, especially women in this field. So I'm always open to those channels and doing that. And I mean, kind of bring it back full circle, though, the first thing I teach in any class is how to engage a client. And everyone comes in and they're like, oh, let's start Googling. And I'm like, nope, we're going to write a contract.
All right. The first thing you want to know is how to charge your customer, not how to do the work. Because frankly, you won't get the work if you don't know how to charge your customer.
Our biggest pitfall in this side of the industry and this type of research is what we call the rabbit hole. And you know, they'll go too far looking for something. And it comes back to, what is the purpose? What is your why? And the contract explains what the why is. Fred wants me to find A. He doesn't want me to find the rest of the alphabet. He really wants me to hyper-focus on A, therefore A. But we'll always get a couple that'll wander off and start, you know, giving me Arabic letters.
Thank you so much. But I was actually looking for something else. Yeah, that's right. Scope is what we call it.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on The Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today. All right, so let's move a little bit forward in time.
Yeah.
So what after Bell, you were at Bell Labs for a long time. What happened after Bell Labs?
10 years later, Latvi Zada comes to me and says, hey, would you like to teach at Berkeley for a year? And my mother had just died, and my kids were getting sick of New Jersey. So I said, let's go to California for a year.
But before you go on, yeah. Latvi Zada, right? So yeah. So tell everybody what he's famous for.
Well, Latvi was famous for fuzzy logic.
Yeah, yeah. That was he a mathematician or not?
I don't know what he was, really. I think he did most of his work under Ragazzini at Columbia. And that Ragazzini was a control theory guy.
That sounds about right for fuzzy logic. Fuzzy logic had its problems. It didn't come out with the right answers. But
it's sort of like quantum. You see, we keep going, as I said, what comes around goes around. Now we've got quantum computing, which is non-deterministic computing. And it sort of resembles fuzzy logic in a sense, because you've got the binary 0 and 1, and then you've got something that is Schrodinger's cat, and you don't know whether it's a 0 or 1 until you try to measure it.
Yeah, it's sort of like that, except there's some other problems. So when you take fuzzy logic down the road, you start to find out that you get inconsistencies.
Yeah, exactly.
And in that sense, it is very much like quantum computers.
And now what you get with quantum computing is you can't trust the
results. You need a statistical number of them in order to do it, which is just what we're doing with other circuits today. Well, anyway.
In fact, you build error-correcting codes.
Well, for so many errors, right? So it's a matter of how much redundancy you need, whether it's in time or in space or a combination. You need the redundancy. You don't know.
It depends on the technology. And if you exceed the capacity of the error-correcting code, you get gibberish.
Yeah, which also then comes back to the mathematics being at the core of this. And, you know, computer science really came out of mathematics in those days. And a lot of people now are just not paying attention to that. You know, they don't understand the fundamentals. They don't do coding theory. They don't do analog stuff. You know, they don't really get it, what's happening at the bottom.
Right.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, so it goes, right? It's very few people today are growing plants from scratch in order to have a bun for a hamburger.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that maybe in a week or two when we get to Cherry, which is this new hardware, new capability hardware. Which now exists after 13 years, exists in real hardware from ARM, and it exists in FPGAs in RISC-V, Cherry RISC-V.
Yep, sure.
So here we have new hardware, new software. This is the third time I've done that. Multics was the first, where we had brand new hardware.
But isn't it fun?
It's fabulous. That's why I'm still working at 90. The second one was...
You mean miles an hour or years old?
years old.
But also you're as quick as you ever were, Peter.
I don't do 90 miles an hour. The second one was for NSA when we designed a hardware software system. It's my first capability architecture at a time when Butler Lampson had the BCC.
Sure.
And Fabry had his version of a capability system, and there were a whole bunch of them at the time. Plessy 250 was one. What we've done today is we've formally proved the correctness of the hardware specification with respect to certain critical properties.
Right, because temperature and pressure and other physical properties can go out of bounds and other things can happen.
Well, this is merely to show that the instruction set itself.
I understand. Right. But it does what it's supposed to do. Yeah.
But we'll get that. Maybe we'll get to that much later on.
So now we're getting into capability architectures and limits on capabilities and all the proof stuff, right? So here's where you're trying to prove stuff with mathematics about instruction sets, for example, but it still doesn't get at the underlying problems of hardware and timing and the analog nature of things. And then the question of what you can actually prove comes at issue. And then the question of what are your assumptions for that proof? And then the question of what are you trying to prove? So which one would you like to start on, Brett?
Oh, my. Well, I will also say, well, add there, though, that with hardware, we actually apply formal methods. And actually, the hardware engineering community has been very supportive of applying formal methods and as well as automation for design. It's actually led the software side of the house. Software side of the house has always been seemingly one step behind, but actually has been used to support the development of the automated tools. It's kind of a funny predicament we're in.
Just for clarity, so in order to cause the hardware to go bad, all we need to do is create a software flaw in the mechanisms that produce the hardware.
Right.
Which, of course, has been done. And then you start to look at the hardware. The hardware gets very tricky. As you get smaller and smaller and closer, then the analog nature and the timing nature of hardware starts to come into play. So you get things like the flaw in multiplication in one of the Intel chips, where the multiplier, when multiplying specific numbers, right, comes up with the wrong answer. So now, in order to exploit that, I have to go back and figure out how to make the output of some calculation depend on that multiplication, so that the wrong answer then spreads that error into the desired bad outcome for the system and puts it into a bad state. It turns out that's not that hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Right? And it's also problematic outside of like the control systems arena. It's also problematic for oil companies. I remember many years ago, I think it was Exxon Mobil, they had people using spreadsheets and they were using an Intel processor on the machine that was running the spreadsheet. And apparently this problem with multiplication of certain numbers actually led to a financial loss because the answer in the spreadsheet came out wrong. And a decision was made based upon that incorrect value on, I don't remember the exact context, but it had to do something with the purchase or trading of oil as a commodity. So
there is this expansive nature. So most things in nature, a minor deviation produces a decreasingly minor variation down the road. So you're walking down the street and your shoe slips by a 16th of an inch on something. Most of the time, you're off by a 16th of an inch. You know, you're not going to get hit by a car because of that, right? On the other hand, in the digital arena, one bit flip almost always has, you know, down the road, potentially catastrophic consequence because it's so brittle with respect to those changes. And so one of the interesting notions of how to build reliable or trustworthy computers out of untrustworthy components is figuring out how to limit the propagation of errors. Now, in the arithmetic space, just doing addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, there were these routines for numerical analysis that were developed for Fortran, the Fortran libraries long ago, that limited the expansion of errors in calculations so that for most cases, when you did these loops with repeated calculations, the errors didn't accumulate. However, if you don't know what you're doing and you're not careful, they do. So most programmers are not taught at all about this. And as a result, they have these mistakes, which brings me to the next mistake, which is when I used to look at programs and I used to do code reviews. So, you know, somebody has a program that's supposed to add two numbers. I remember at a conference long ago for security educators, they were looking for problems for graduate students to give to graduate students to teach them about security. And I said, okay, here's my problem. I want you to add two numbers together and always get the right answer. It was declared too hard. So, no, that's too hard to be able to do secure. Well, I'm sorry. If we can't add two numbers together, what exactly can you do in computers that doesn't involve that? So there are all sorts of major challenges we face at the fundamental level of understanding what we're doing, that because it's digital instead of analog, and because of this expansion and propagation property, are enormously problematic.
Yeah, I've actually seen this in play. I was one of the early developers in the 90s of fully automated driving at UC Berkeley. And there was a very large research team working this endeavor. And we had a test vehicle that we took out, and based upon our simulations of the system, not actually in the vehicle, but actually simulating the running of the software in the simulated environment, the system seemed to work fine. But when we actually put the software into the vehicle and was and controlled the, we had a lateral control system, which means that this was the system for controlling the steering of the vehicle, maintaining the vehicle on the lanes. We noticed that the vehicle would steer gradually off the roadway. And we and, a lot, and on this test track, we had very large eucalyptus trees. The eucalyptus trees would win in a crash. And what we found was that it was a matter of our simulation models were not very high fidelity in terms of the kinematics or the physics of the actual motions and you know vibrations and things of the vehicle, and we also did not capture well the signal processing part of the system. So we were getting this accumulated error based upon these outliers that were not being really pushed down dampened and actually amplified over time and would cause the car to change the steering angle output of the control system so that the car would steer off the roadway.
But it didn't steer towards emergency vehicles.
No.
No, that's the current version of the problem, yeah. Which is, I think, considerably worse, you know, because the directed attack. So, you know, the current learning methodology has this huge learning problem, right? That you're going to learn this misbehavior. Right. So if you directed machine learning towards listening to things that Congress does, then I don't want to make a political comment because it's against the rules of the show, but I'm just saying it would be highly disruptive to society as a whole if artificial intelligence learned to emulate politics.
Yeah, and we're seeing that with, speaking of artificial intelligence and coming back to Peter's talk, you know, Lofty's Auto was a major influence on the development of artificial intelligence and, you know, pushing forward things like deep neural network research. And now deep neural networks are everywhere. People are applying them, all kinds of problems, even problems that they probably aren't really the best tool to apply to. But, you know,
yeah, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Exactly. And we also see that people are trying to take advantage of AI systems, such as deep neural networks. They're using techniques known as adversarial AI, where they, you know, they put some bird poo smeared on a stop sign and make the computer think it's the stop sign is something else, and the vehicle goes right on through the stop sign. It doesn't make the connection that that's a hexagonal sign that's red and with the letters.
Right, because the AI is not explainable or explained by the things that we associate with the properties of a stop sign. It's learned that a white dot next to a red dot with green behind it, you know, over on the left part of the screen is a stop sign instead of learning what a stop sign. So, yeah.
Right.
And of course, but just for clarity, you know, when you study cognition in animals, the same is true. For example, for birds, if you want to walk close to a bird without offending it, depending on the particular bird, one of the things you can do is just put your arms behind your back and put on a hat with a bill, and you'll look like a bird with a beak to them, and they won't worry about you and your arms. And so animals have these, and people have these, and you can intentionally induce cognitive errors by induction and suppression of signal. And the same, by the way, is true of the cognitive systems of computers. So it's not that we are somehow better. It's that we're starting to learn the things we already knew about our ineptness.
Yes, I agree. Interesting note, Lofty Zada, I had the pleasure of actually getting to know him while I was working at UC Berkeley. And I went to his house, and it turned out he was an audiophile. He had speakers in every room of his home and multiple stereo systems. It was quite an interesting experience.
So there's another thing about fuzzy logic, and that is at two levels of fuzzy logic, it's palpably inconsistent. Mm-hmm. So as a fundamental concept, it's problematic. And if you look at neural networks, when you go to multiple levels of depth, they become increasingly difficult to predict and understand, and they can come up with crazy things as well. So limiting the depth, what happens as you increase the depth is you get inconsistencies out of it and very unpredictable results. And again, I believe it has to do with the fact that it's divergent instead of convergent, that it's the nature of the mechanisms that instead of being smooth over a space, they become non-smooth, and that causes divergent outputs. So minor deviations in the input create large deviations in the output, and that's produces inconsistencies. Now I've just said something that's not only unfathomable to the audience, but you also didn't probably get it. So I think I'm going to stop here.
Okay.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. All right. So, Julie, last time we were talking about your first encounter with computer-related crime, where somebody who worked for you ended up being arrested by the FBI, and they came into your office to introduce themselves. So after that, is that when you started to get interested in investigations and computer crime, or what happened next?
Well, actually, I left Travelers, and I tried a couple of different things in between, but then I went back to third-party administration, which was kind of the Wild West for...
Hang on. What were the other things you tried in between?
I worked as an administrator for an institutional review board that was set up by one of the professors that was in my law school class, in my law school class.
Wait a minute. You didn't mention that you went to law school here. So
I went to law school in between.
Just bother to mention that one. All right. So you went to law school. Don't miss these minor things like getting more advanced degrees. I realize to you they're minor, but to most people they're major. You have quite a few of those, right?
Yeah, but this was the second one I got. It was in between doing something in the evenings, and so it was a night school. It was a law school night school, and I went there for 3 years, I think it was. So meanwhile, I was working at Travelers, and then. So once I got my law degree, or I was, I think, in the final year or something, I did do some clerking for the guy that owned the law school, an attorney in out of Pomona, and worked with him doing some things as a clerk, and where you could actually be mentored and go into court and things like that. So did some work like that. And then also that was shifting from the institutional review board with the other person that I worked for a period. That was a short period of time I worked as an administrator for this IRB, for this professor at UC Irvine, basically.
Okay. And then what?
And then I went to Wilmington, a real happening city in LA, not so much, but and worked for the United Industrial Workers Union. It was really worked for a third party administrator called Patrick Tui and Associates, and they were actually out of Portland, Oregon, and worked as the trust manager for United Industrial Workers Trust Fund. So,
what is a trust manager?
A trust manager is basically, they call them plan administrators, technically under ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. So, kind of is the oversight regulatory statute involving employee benefits in the U.S. For private affecting private employers. So I worked as the person that was actually responsive to all the board of trustees for this Taft. It's a Taft, what's called a Taft-Hartley trust fund, and it's a collectively bargained organization between employers and the union itself. So there were a number of employer representatives that were on that board from Starkist Foods, which is part of H.J. Heinz, and Pan Pacific Fisheries, La Victoria Foods, and Harbor Canning, which makes Juanita products.
So you're the trust administrator. Does that mean you did the investments or what?
No, I did not do the investments. We did everything that was non-fiduciary. So the investments were designated with an investment manager that the board of trustees selected. And but that trust manager basically did all the day-to-day administrative work and get checks, pension checks out to the beneficiaries, make sure that the enrollments into the health plans are done. So you manage all the staff to do all that kind of work administratively for the trust fund, and then you report to the board every time they have a board meeting, and you are the one that's basically the secretary to the board. So,
so now during that tenure there, did any of your employees get arrested by the FBI?
Actually, the former trust manager was stealing from the fund.
So you've been affiliated with criminal enterprises for your entire career.
Well, not on purpose, but it just happened that way, but we're not done yet because I have another one after this.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. and on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. One of the longest standing deception methods is the phony job interview. So a lot of people use this for frauds, both as employers and as employees. I'm just going to be looking at fraud, spies, and lies and how to defeat them on section 2.6.2.3, phony job interviews, employer.
In places where jobs are hard to find, fake job listings are created to generate interviews where the interviewer collects information on the potential employee like name, social security number, date of birth, and so forth. All of the information required for identity theft.
We're seeing this increasingly on social media platforms where you can apply for jobs and nobody really knows who they're talking to when they're applying for a job. In fact, people put up assertions that they're from some company they're not from and take your job application. They may even do an interview. So be careful in filling out those forms. Now, on the other side, section 2.6.2.4, phony job interviews by the employee.
Some folks who want to get information on a company will arrange to get a job interview by applying for a job with a fake resume. In the interview process, they will ask questions and get tours of facilities that they can then exploit for the information on what is where, to plant a surveillance device, or to leave an explosive if sabotage or extortion is their goal.
Fundamental to both aspects of this is that it's an intelligence process, and the intelligence process is one of filling in the table of the things you want to know. This is also known as the puzzle problem. Basically, we have a puzzle that we're trying to fill in about our target, whether it's a human being or an organization or you name it. As we fill in different components of the puzzle, it ends up with less and less stuff we need to know. So we might come from different directions to get the information that we want for whatever our purpose is. For example, we might lie about being a girl and express interest to get information on a birthday or where you're living or where you are these days and so forth. On the other hand, we might want to get financial information, so then we're going to pose as a loan company, you know, wanting to give you a loan, a business loan or a personal loan or what have you. Or we might act like we're a car company giving you a discount on cars. So you get a big discount on the cars, you just have to fill out the form to apply for the credit. So you get the idea. The point here is that all the information you give out on the internet is information that can be exploited. The totality of that information is potentially the information available to somebody who wants to do something to you. So the solution to this is to identify the sets of information that you think are allowable and accessible to anybody. And in my case, I put them on a website, fc0.co. I put that there. It points to other websites. It has all the information I'm willing to publicly release. When people ask me about myself, I point them to that website. When they want a picture, I point them to the website. When they want information on my resume, I point them to that website, and so on and so forth. So I've already decided what I'm going to release, and it's already been released, and I know what's out there, and I know the potential for what they can do with it. The other stuff, something that's, you know, a bank account number or something like that, I'm much more careful about, and I only do it outbound when I decide I want to interact with them, not when they want to interact with me. So that's the phony job interview take on filling in the puzzle and the puzzle problem. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Netix, the other half of cyber.
Now, on to our next service provider. We're talking to Wynn, who is perhaps the most influential person in the world when it comes to teaching children about how to be safe and ethical in the cyber world. Wynn, welcome back. So,
I appreciate it.
When we were talking earlier, we were talking about, you started to notice that time was important. And there are two books that you wrote that I think are two of the best books in cybersecurity ever written. And one of them is the time-based security book. And the other one is Internet Ethics for Children and Their Teachers and Parents and Parents.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could walk us through those, how you come up with the idea, how you executed on it, especially the one for children. My goodness, you gave away or sold for next to nothing gobs of these things. Tell us about that.
I had kids at the time. See, my daughter, I guess, was in teen years. My son was actually breaking into networks on live television when he was nine. And as those were occurring, I said, you know, what's the rest of the universe doing? What are the rest of parents doing? Do they have any clue what's going on? Because certainly the teachers and the administrators in schools viewed a computer lab as an Apple II sitting in a corner playing either Donkey Kong, Gorilla, or Oregon Trail. And that was the extent of the knowledge, even though this was, the internet had, quote unquote, been around 5 years, 4 years, if you want to use it.
That's not much around.
And so I was talking to my wife and I said, we really should write something about this. So I wrote this book. And Jennifer Granick was a great help, if you remember that name. She is a stupendous lawyer. I think she works in DHS now. And she was my legal advisor. And I was able to, in those days, get sponsors. And we got enough sponsors to print 475,000 copies of this thing and give away massive, massive, massive numbers of them around the country. And then a couple of years later, they kept selling and kept selling. And it just became a thing, and I have never updated it since. I probably should have, but frankly, I moved on to other projects.
When it doesn't need much updating. It's because it's about ethics. It's about these more fundamental aspects of how you treat other people, how they should treat you, and how you think about things. And those are the things that tend to last and have great value.
There's some good work being done these days. Nice Kids is doing work. It's becoming a little bit more mainstream, but it has morphed more into cyber safety to protect yourself versus interactive behavior. And an awful lot of what we were trying to do back then were from experiences and stuff that I saw with my kids and some of the situations that they ended up in. And I wanted to make people think. That was really the goal of that book, was to make people think, get them out of their comfort zone. And I guess my career has always been getting people out of their comfort zone as much as possible.
That's probably why I like you so much.
Well, I appreciate that, Fred. Thank you.
Yes. Wynn and Fred, bringing discomfort to the world. So, Chris, thing number one is, I've written quite a few cybersecurity books. And I always tried to write the best book I could write. When I saw Wynn's book on this, I couldn't believe it. I was just like, man, I've been working so hard to try and make such good books and write all these papers. This is just so much better than anything I ever did. And I announced, I told everybody I knew right away, best book ever.
So, well, it's a human thing, right? Everybody's talking about, AI and ChatGPT right now, right? And, there's, as you say, a human being can look to write something and create it one way or another. And, how you actually put it all together the other day, Wynn's a great storyteller. It just is, right? Can you quantify that? Can I get AI to do that? Maybe. You're going to repeat the same things already done, but you can't, I don't think, predict, the next one.
So I think a big part of what it is his background in the industry, in the music industry, in the record industry. They do production and album covers and all these things. And his book had really excellent cartoons and good humor and it was laid out very well. And I wrote a book and had my son illustrate it, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. But just the skill and the set of people that he got together to create what those quality books are is fabulous. Add to that his perspective on it. He's talking about the ethical and moral issues. And, you know, me, I drilled him down into details and everything. And he kept it at a high level, at a reasonable level, where anybody can look at it and say, oh, that makes sense. And yet his coverage was wonderful. Right? And, he covered all sorts of things that I wish I covered that. You know, oh, my goodness.
Well, and I think I have the right dates for this, because at the same time, you know, most people probably didn't read Blinn's book. Most people probably heard those public service announcements on TV. As I recall, went something like this. Parents, if you are irresponsible enough to allow the internet in your home, make sure that there's only one computer the children have access to. It's in a table by itself in the middle of a well-lit room, and there's always at least three adults staring at the child while using the computer. Scared, but it was. It was like, oh, you know, and you know, you could see it run among friends and family. It's like, oh, yes, and we allow the internet. You know, the kids have internet, but only between these hours, and we have this stuff on it. It's like, yeah, okay. I think you're thinking about this the wrong way, right? You need to, you know, be a little bit Mr. Rogers, be a little bit Wynn Schwartz out, right?
The whole point of it is getting people to think about things mm-hmm. in terms of what's right and what's good and about your effects on other people. No religion in it, right? None of this holier than thou, none of this.
No technology.
Reason. Yeah, right. It's not about technology. It's about doing unto others, but not in a preachy way, in a simple way.
Right.
And it's wonderful. I can't believe that he's so much better at it than I am. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Rogers, right? I mentioned, Mr. Rogers, you know, is amazing, right? And one of the best things I ever heard about Mr. Rogers was from his wife. And you can see her saying this, somebody saying, oh, your husband's just, you know, saying he's so amazing and everything else. Like, look, he's not perfect. He's a human being. But he sat down and thought about it. Children, if you're 5 or 6 years old, you think differently. All the rest of us as adults don't think that way. You have to actually stop and think about it. You know, what is it like being 5, 6 years old? Speak to that. And as we're talking about here with Wynn and his books and so forth, it's, you know, not necessarily 5, 6 years old, but speak to people, speak to your audience. Think about who they are. You know, engineers, I think so much of, you know, the content production like we're doing right now, right? And the stuff we both do in various contexts, I think that's going through an evolutionary phase for these same reasons. Because engineers, you know, will like put some Zoom together with a calendar invite and invite some fantastic people. And it's like, you know, it's like try to hold a party and you have all the colors right and everything else, nobody shows up or they don't have a good time, right? Because it's not about the size of the room. It's not about, you know, you have to think about the people you're working with. It's all people, not technology.
I think that it's in many ways asking too much of people to be good across this full spectrum, right? People who are good at, you know, design and engineering and mathematics and who spend their lives doing this are just unlikely to be good at the social niceties. And people who spend their lives and times thinking about other people and the social niceties are unlikely to be good at the mathematics and engineering, because you have only so much time and you spend it on this or that or the other thing.
Right.
It's a really rare person that can cross all these spectrums and be good at all of these things. And I think it's a fantasy. And I think that's exactly what, you know, Mrs. Rogers said.
Right. Well, right, exactly, right, and it's not just a rare person; that's a non-existent person. You know, you can't get there from here. What you can get is people who have a whole bunch of cross-disciplinary, you know, skill sets or tendencies and whatnot. And then you can get two or three of those, and between that's why we have teams. That's why we have cultures and societies, because none of us is the best at everything. You know, and to our point here, none of us is really any one thing either. You know, a carpenter. You're a carpenter. You might also be a poetry expert, right? Who knows? People are people.
Getting those mixes of people in groups to be good at working together and successful, whatever that means, is also very hard. And you would think
that's another.
You would think that there are people that are really skilled at that and can do it consistently, but I've not seen it.
Well, no, and it's one of the fascinating things about our period right now in our industry, right? You know, I'm disappointed with myself because I'm disappointed with us as a group. It's like, we're the ones who think about these things all the time. And we use a word like social engineering, you know, to brush away all of human behavior. It's like, well, I made the cryptographic thing right. And I told them not to hit the key. It's like, who are they? I don't care. Like, what do you mean you don't care? It's all about people. It's all about sociology, right? So we, you know, but again, you know, the nature of our cohort is that, you know, that, you know, yes, and then there are those amongst us who are really, really good at it, but it's just not, you know, that trade does not run thick in our community. But it's getting, we're partnering with people like Anthony Sawyers and so forth, who actually know this stuff really well, and it's fun.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you that in my experience, and I think I have a lot of it, I've not found anybody who's really good at that full social thing. That sometimes they can do it once, sometimes they can do it a couple of times, but
many in the industry think I'm one of those folks. It's the one-eyed man in the land of the blind, right? You know,
it's not, because I'm not blind. And so, and you know, and I've tried this many times. I've engaged with many people that, you know, are, in the view of many other people, very good at it. And it's not that they're bad at it. It's that they have their imperfections too. We right. all do.
Right.
And well, especially me, but you know, all right, let's move on.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on the Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
This segment of our show is on artificial intelligence, or as I like to say, ay. I ask ChatGPT to tell me a one-minute story about how cybernetic systems can replace human flaws. Here's what it told me, compressed to fit in the 1 minute.
Once upon a time, in a not-so-distant future, a company specializing in cybernetic systems introduced a new product that aimed to replace human flaws. This product was a small implant that could be inserted into a person's body and connected directly to their brain, allowing them to access advanced computing, power, and artificial intelligence. At first, people were skeptical of the implant and its capabilities. However, as more and more people started to use it, they began to see the benefits it offered. With the implant, people could think and process information much faster, make better decisions, and even enhance their physical abilities. As time went on, the implant became more advanced and sophisticated. It allowed people to do things that were once thought to be impossible, like perfectly recall every detail of a conversation or solve complex mathematical equations in mere seconds. The implant made people stronger, smarter, and more capable than ever before. However, as the implant became more widespread, some began to question the consequences of relying so heavily on technology to replace human flaws. Some argued that it would lead to a society where people were no longer in control of their own thoughts and actions. Others warned that relying on technology to replace human flaws would ultimately lead to the loss of our humanity. Despite these concerns, the implant continued to grow in popularity, and eventually, it became a necessity for people to have if they wanted to keep up with the rest of society. And as time passed, it seemed as though the implant had successfully replaced human flaws and made people better, stronger, and more advanced than ever before.
And so we see, just like human beings, AI always wants to say more than what we asked for. I guess talking too much is one of those human flaws that's not going to be replaced by AI. And when it comes to following directions, AI is just as good as people at not doing what we tell it to do.
Now, on to our next service provider.
We're talking to Ira, who is perhaps one of the world's best-known red team leaders when it comes to the cyber arena.
Going in during the morning rush hour where, I mean, you know, one guy on my team, and he wasn't even a former Navy SEAL. This was something I would never have expected this guy to do, but he ended up going into a classified facility or going into a government contracting facility. We allowed him, you know, he was allowed to do this, and he just basically followed everybody in during rush hour. He was walking around, so everybody was walking into a meeting room. And he sat down at a meeting for a jet bomber.
Yeah.
And it's like,
turned his tape recorder while he was there.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, well, good job. I mean,
well, the problem being that clearly they didn't have even the nominal level of protection that you should have for that environment. So they're just not doing the job at all. On the other hand, we look at things, you know, I worked at Sandia National Labs for a while. And so we did some exercises there with, you know, children. You know, some of them less than 21 years old, but they were all 18 and legally allowed to work. And so they ended up having to, you know, have meetings where they explained how you can't tell anybody what you found here. but these are much more serious environments. I don't imagine you're going to be able to walk into you know, these sorts of facilities without being identified on route. No matter how big the crowd is, no matter how many people are coming by, they just won't let them all in. They'll just stop each one of them and verify it.
And the answer to that is it depends.
We've tested those things pretty well. So, but yeah, they're different facilities, right? And it's like, look, you could probably get into those facilities also by, you know, so we had a world-class gymnast on one of our teams. So really handy to have somebody that's very small and very quick and extremely agile that can jump very high and hold themselves, you know, over a wall on one finger, right? You know,
yeah.
So there's all sorts of stuff they can do that I can't, right? And so when you have the right team and you distract somebody by having them look this way while that person jumps over the facility and you've already created an incident the other side, there's always some level of interruption of the security mechanism, the detection mechanism that will allow something to get by it. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that. It's that when you're actually going on the offense to do that, you have to do one after another of those. Right. And there's enough redundant systems in place, then you do get caught. I mean, not just the vast majority of the time, every time so far. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that you can't get into the facilities. I've actually been in a situation where I ended up in a facility where I should not have been allowed to get in. I did point out to them that I should not be allowed to get in here, please, because I didn't really want to go to jail. Yeah. But then the red teams, you know, we've had red teams. Succeed, you know, you're trying to get bad thing out.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the decisions they made was, well, we got in, however we got in, and we needed to get bad thing out. So we got bad thing out. We didn't get out. We were caught, but we got bad thing out. So now you're talking about things like quadcopters, right? And right. Things that can shoot projectiles. So if you can get something in that can shoot a projectile and you can get the thing into your projectile shooter and shoot it out, then all I have to do is reach the target and exfiltrate the bad thing. I don't have to get myself out. So if you're willing to sacrifice yourself. You know, so again, depending on what you're trying to achieve, there's no limit, right?
Well, yeah. And here's the thing, though. I try. So the key concept, though, is it. I look at it, if I get caught, that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing for the facility. Too many people try to. Like, too many people, if you're going to do social engineering or something similar, you need to realize that part of the job is, again, figuring out how to secure things and knowing specifically where they are in their level of maturity of, well, their level of maturity and how well they can catch things. Because you have to figure out at what point does their detection succeed or break. Because knowing that that is where the line is, that tells you where things need to be improved so you can leave it better.
Well, and now that presumes that you get good intelligence, which has to do with the counterintelligence process, which should, if properly done and the consequences are sufficiently high, cause you to misinterpret what's going on so that you think the threshold is not exceeded when it is.
Well, you really have to try to, if you're going to do a good red teaming exercise or good pen test or whatever, you need to and want to figure out, in my opinion, where you need to go to be caught. Where is the line to be caught? And that's important because this way you can tell them where they need to start improving. Now, if you can literally walk in and say, hey, give me this, and they give it to you, and without any pressure,
right.
Then they have zero detection capability. On the other hand, if you can start probing and they're starting, okay, I need to see some ID, I need to see this. And yes, you can go ahead and say, okay, even provide them a fake ID. And then they could be like, okay, this looks
well, or we create fake IDs.
Right. External. I mean, well, that's what I mean. You like a good person, generally you create your fake IDs. You know, you have different badges and stuff like that.
Yeah, you got to be at a conference with the badge out and you've gotten in, you know.
Yeah, so you just need to be able to go ahead and see where the detection is. Do people just take you at face value? Does a team, for example, go ahead and say, I need to talk to my manager before I can give you anything.
All right. So this is, when I talk about this, I really talk about not red teaming, but protection testing. Mm-hmm. And the point of testing is I have to know what the protection is in order to test it. Because if I know what it's, you know, look, it's not these things. You don't have that protection. Why would I bother to test it? Because right. We already know it's not there. So the real point is to identify what is there and test that, and then independently identify all the stuff that's not there. And, you know, so we know lots of paths to get there that you're not protecting against. There's no reason to test it. Oh, we're testing it because the CEO says, I don't believe it. All right. So we'll do that. If you pay me, I'll make something believable for the CEO. But reality is we're trying to figure out whether what you're trying to do is working or not. And then separately, whether that's adequate and appropriate to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
I think this time we start to get at the issues, right?
Yeah, I'm just sitting here listening to Ira and you talk about this. And it's, yeah, this is the fun stuff, folks, right? This is the fun, honest to God stuff about security that's as 007, you know, Q, as you think, right? You know, that you know, my uncle, Vance Jones, a great, great guy. He was a locksmith. When I was 6 or 7 years old, he showed me how to pick locks and took them apart, showed me how they worked, you know, the rake and the wrench for a key lock and how to feel, you know, a dial lock. And little kids have great fingers for this too. You know, fantastic. You just feel it. You close your eyes and feel those wheels engage. But the, you know, the nuts and bolts of how you do this, you know, and Ira said a couple of things. You know, maturity levels, the maturity level of your team, the maturity level of the organization, your pen testing. And, you know, I just have to finish this little rant with the policy hacking statement, you know, from our last conversation about this. You know, it's for me taking, I always thought about Uncle Vance and those locks all my life and growing up in the social engineering, the hacking, you know, systems, getting into places physically I'm not supposed to be. It's just fascinating. I always think of the same thing as those locks. You just sit there and watch people, watch how this system's working. You know, how's the company working? If I were on the outside, you know, what am I looking at? And that, it gets fun on the mechanics. It doesn't it just though.
You know, when I look at this, you know, we talk about maturity to me is sort of the biggest thing here, right? The maturity, when we're talking about the maturity, we're talking about, to me, the fundamental of what's going on if you're going to be effective at protection, right? So the maturity level you need, and for those that don't know about the capability maturity model, right? It starts out with none. I've never done this before. Then you have the initial, the first time you do something, then you make it repeatable. So the same stuff produces the same results, at least statistically. That's repeatable. And then you have you document it and get the details down so you can do that and write it up. And that's called defined maturity. And you go from there to managed. And managed, you're measuring all these things that you're looking at, all that defined stuff. You're taking the data, measuring it, and improving it, or trying to improve it, or at least making sure it's working as you desire. And then there's another level called optimized that nobody ever reaches that's trying to be perfect because the world changes. So the point here is to get up to managed, to where you have a system that's operating on a normal basis. But for cybersecurity, that has to be at the threat level that you face, right? So if you're a shoe store and, you know, the cyber attacks have such and such a consequences, you don't have to be very mature. And you can be managed maturity pretty darn simply for running that shoe store in terms of the cash register might be the only thing you have, right? So you can do everything you need to make sure that cash register works right without any problem at all. It's really easy to get very sophisticated about it. On the other hand, if you're running, you know, a manufacturing facility that's producing, you know, radios that are used by the military, the threat profile is a lot different. So to get to that level of maturity takes a lot more in that situation. So I like it that Ira got to that point. And I think that point is truly fundamental. The other thing is it's all contextual. There is no generic solution to any of this stuff, right?
Right. And this is why red teaming, as we discussed before, can be a very good thing. Right. You know, if you do a red team exercise, you find a vulnerability and you fix that vulnerability, you failed. Right. What you want is to have a conversation. Say, look, it's not that you need to, you know, put a lock on that door. You don't have a process for determining what door should have locks. So maybe we should think about that. You know, let's advance along together. And as you said, exactly right. You know, there are levels, we have ways we talk about this, you know, not doing anything at all. Maybe that's fine. You know, you and I have, you know, gone through this with notional organizations where you find out that, you know, what they should do is next to nothing. It all depends.
That's right. And they really like that result, although they're always surprised by it.
Right.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Sin uses a cute smile, a short skirt, and a hair flip to break a knuckle dragger. Peter goes to Stanford and gets stuck with student riots. Julie decides she would rather hunt than be hunted. Wynn flushes out time for Plato's cave. Ira attributes stupidity to malice, and war frauds get exposed. This and a whole lot more on next week's Cyber Show.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.